You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or subscribe to Brookings Podcasts through iTunes or your favorite podcast app. You can also follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
Welcome, everybody, this afternoon. And thank you also for braving the traffic. The World Gas Conference, an event every 3 years, is happening here in Washington, and so the streets are clogged with people from the gas industry. My name is David Victor, and I co-chair with Bruce Jones the Cross Brookings Initiative on Energy and Climate. This is an effort to bake into all of what Brookings does on geopolitics, on technology, on economic growth, all of what Brookings does, more attention to energy issues and climate issues, based on the logic that many energy policy decisions and, frankly, most climate policy decisions are constrained and driven to some degree by what countries are willing and able to do for other reasons. And so that's why we're organizing the Cross Brookings effort this way. And it's really my pleasure to introduce Fatih Birol, who will be with us for the next hour and a half. Fatih is the head of the International Energy Agency. Prior to that, was the chief economist of the International Energy Agency, is the face of all of the major products of the International Energy Agency, including its flagship effort, the World Energy Outlook. He was formerly at OPEC, trained in engineering and in economics in Turkey, where he was born, and in Vienna. And you have his bio, I think, in the materials that were circulated in advance of this meeting. I just want to say that there's one very important omission, which is that Fatih is a lifelong honorary member of the Galatasaray football club in Turkey, which is the most important and successful football club in Turkey.
In the world, not in Turkey. So
the world. I stand
more
I stand,
or less.
And I can say for the Americans, every 4 years we're allowed just to call it football. And so enjoy that while it lasts, because it won't last forever. So I want to say just one thing before we get started, and then Fatih's going to make a few opening remarks about how he sees the big picture changing, and then we'll have a conversation for 45 minutes or so, and then I'll open it up for a broader set of questions and discussions with the audience. And I guess what I want to say is that, frankly, the energy business used to be kind of a dull industry, because you'd wake up in the morning and you'd do the same thing you did the day before. You kind of knew where to look for resources. If you were running an electric company, you kind of knew what to do. You built a slightly larger power plant, slightly longer power lines. You did the same thing over and over again. This world is now transforming on almost every single front. You know, the question of what are the frontier supplies of oil? Now we're looking at horizontal drilling and fracturing of shales in a way that was not conceivable a decade ago, or certainly 15 years ago. We're looking at tremendous changes in costs. We're looking in the electric power sector at potentially complete transformation of the grid, such that the incumbent companies might not exist in some cases, or maybe they become more powerful. Nobody's quite sure. And, of course, amazing changes in technology. And so on the one hand, that has created an enormous set of opportunities. And on the other hand, it's created an amazing degree of risk. And this industry is nothing if not capital intensive. And so how those risks affect the future structure of the industry, where people invest, what that infrastructure looks like, those are the central questions. They are questions that can't really be addressed seriously without a look at the whole picture, a systematic, model-based framework, and it's hard to imagine anybody in a better position to do that than Fatih Birol. When people think gravitas in energy analysis, they think Fatih Birol, and so it's really a pleasure to have you with us this afternoon. You want to make a few opening remarks as to how you see the big picture changing, and then I want to drill in and talk about a few aspects of it.
Thank you very much, David, and thank you very much for inviting me to Brookings. So this is very nice to come back after a few years. So I would like to leave the time for discussing with you and with the colleagues here, Q&A. But perhaps I make one observation strategically, and second, two important data points, important developments in the recent times. I want to highlight this too. So when we look at the future of energy, we see four major upheavals that will shape our energy system in the next two decades or so. What are these four upheavals, as we call? Number one, China. China is changing, I'm talking about in energy terms, so is the Chinese energy system, and so is the implications on the global markets. When we talk about China, we talk China, remember, lots of coal, oil, and so on. But recently, David, the Chinese Communist Party Congress, it is the most important instant in the Chinese system, decided that China will push the clean energy. And President Xi, in his final remarks, a very long manifesto in the opening, the closing session of the Chinese Communist Party Congress, they summarized this under the motto of making the skies of China blue again. And today, China is the number one in terms of wind, number one in terms of solar, number one in terms of electric cars, number one in terms of energy efficiency, number one in terms of natural gas demand growth, and many things. So China is changing, and we will see the implications of this on the markets, as we have seen for the oil markets, oil prices, for the coal, CO2 emissions, etc. This is number one. China is changing and moving to the clean energy direction, cleaner energy direction. Number two, renewable energies, especially solar and wind, are getting cheaper. And cheaper and cheaper, and they are becoming the cheapest source of electricity generation in many emerging countries as well, in terms of generation cost. And we see a boom of solar followed by wind. There are challenges coming from this in terms of integrating them in the system, but the cost is coming down. So compared to last time when I came to Brookings, perhaps 6-7 years ago, when I compare at that time renewables and now, renewables are not anymore a romantic story. It's a business now, mainstream business. When I say renewables, it is solar and wind. So this is the second transformation, in my view, dimension of the next decades to come. Number three, United States. Almost 7 years ago, 7 years ago, in our World Energy Outlook, we wrote something in the executive summary. 7 or 8 years ago, Doug Engel would remember, he was at our board. We said a silent revolution is taking place in North America, talking about the shale revolution. And it was very silent. At that time, I even made a joke. Nobody laughed. It was, I said, normally revolutions happen in South America, but this time happening in North America.
We laugh this time.
This time, thank you very much. Very kind of you. So, and that silent revolution we have foreseen, shale, became very loud now. And our numbers show that U.S. will be the undisputed leader of oil and gas production growth many years to come. Tomorrow, we are releasing our 5-year gas market outlook forecast, and the numbers are very, very impressive, I can tell you that. So this is the U.S. This is the U.S. is coming, and the implications of this will be felt from the trade flows to geopolitics of energy, from geopolitics of energy to the implications for the other exporters and also many importers, gas and oil importers, who even will not ever import 1 BCM of American gas will benefit from this. If you wish, I can explain that. So this is the third dimension, U.S., oil and gas, and U.S. becoming the undisputed leader of oil and gas production growth for many years to come. Fourth and the last dimension is electrification. Our energy system is being electrified. What do I mean with this? When we look at the numbers, which we do, you know, we make our hands dirty with data, energy demand is growing, but electricity demand is growing 2 times faster than the energy demand. So we are seeing that in the buildings, in the households, in industry sector, slowly but surely in the transportation sector, share of electricity also aggravated by the digitalization of our social lives, electricity demand is growing very, very strongly. And this has major implications. And this is coming mainly from emerging countries. In the United States, or let me put it, not I don't want to talk about the United States much, but let's talk about Europe. In Europe, we discuss a lot, in Brussels especially, should the share of the renewables be 37%, 33%, and so a couple of percentage points of the current European electricity generation. But India, in the next 20 years, is adding to its capacity one entire Europe. India is adding one Europe equivalent. So it is so important what will be done there. In US, you are discussing the coal and gas and renewables. China is adding one United States in the next 20 years. The choice, technology choice of China, India will be extremely important. So electrification is coming from there, and what kind of decisions will be made in those countries will lock in our technological system, because as we all know, when you build a power plant, it has a lifetime of 40, 50 years. So the choice and the technology will be very important there. So this electrification of our energy and economy is very important. To sum up, we see four major upheavals. China is changing, going into direction of cleaner energy systems. Second, we see that the renewables, solar and wind, especially becoming cheaper and can be competitive in many cases vis-a-vis traditional energy sources. Third, United States set to become the undisputed leader of oil and gas minerals to come. And fourth is the as I mentioned, electrification of our energy system. So these are the four strategic dimensions for the next 20 years to come. Now, before going to the Q&A, I want to mention two very recent data points, which I think important to underline. One is on the climate change front. Carbon dioxide emissions are the most important greenhouse gas when you look at the energy sector, and which we do. We look at every year very closely the CO2 emissions. And we were very happy the years 14, 15, and 16 because global CO2 emissions did not increase. They were flat, 14, 15, 16. When you look at the history, emissions always increase if there is no financial crisis. In the recent past, it decreased only in the year 2009 when we had the financial crisis. Except for that, every year it increased, but 14, 15, 16, it was flat. We were very happy that we said at least it is not enough to reach the targets, but at least there is the saturation flat. But we had the 2017 numbers, and we were very disappointed because once again, global emissions increased. 14, 15, 16 flat, despite a very strong economic growth worldwide. Economy grew, but the emissions were flat. But 17, again an increase. And I can tell you something. I don't know if it's a good news or bad news. The largest, some countries increased, some countries decreased in the world. Largest decline of CO2 emissions in the world came from the United States, just for the records. We just look at the numbers. This is something that I think we need to see, and it is something important to underline and look at behind the rhetorics, behind the discussions. Last data point, something about the a subject which some of you know I follow since several years, electricity access in developing countries. So when we have started, we look at every year in the IEA, how many people in the world have no access to electricity and where are they, these people? If you take your problem seriously, you first measure it. We measure every year what is the development, is it progress or not. Since we have started to measure this data, when we started first, there were three major areas where we have seen the problematic countries, areas: China, India, and Sub-Saharan Africa. Starting from 1990s, China, around year 2000, fixed that problem. China completely went frontal and had a universal access. And now, as of April 2018, India fixed this problem. In India now, all the villages have access to electricity. It's a big thing. In my view, it's a very big thing. India brought electricity to almost 500 million people in a very short period of time. Big part of the success, the credit, goes to Prime Minister Modi and his government. They took it very seriously and go. And now the problem is left, which has started China, India, and Africa problem. It is now left only Sub-Saharan Africa, where we have still substantial amount of people, 2 out of 3 people have no access to electricity. So this is a data point. I was very happy to, because we work very closely with the Indian government, with the new IEA, I should say, that India have now universal access, all the villages in India have universal access to electricity. So these are two data points on the CO2 emissions and also on the side of the access to electricity I wanted to mention.
Excellent. Thank you very much. So this is an enormously helpful overview. Let's take a few minutes and talk about each of these upheavals and the data points. We start with the older industry, the oil industry.
Yeah.
2014 oil prices came down very quickly. People started talking about lower for longer. Then people started talking about lower forever. I live in San Diego, and I get to commute between Washington and San Diego, which means I get to fly over the Permian Basin in West Texas on a regular basis, and I open the window, look down. It's just every time you go over, something's different. It's an extraordinary change that's happened in the United States. Has this transformed where prices come in the global market, and so therefore we're basically lower forever?
I wouldn't say lower forever. As we see, it is now over.
Forever is a long time.
Forever is a long time, exactly. And we don't know if we have, if we need oil forever. We will need oil for several years to come, but forever we don't know. Anyways, I think that U.S. coming in the picture set a ceiling to how high the prices can go up. If there is a high price, it will induce more U.S. oil. Now, we are seeing the second wave of U.S. shale coming to the market. Only next year, 2019, 75% of the growth in global oil will come from the United States, the shale. And if the prices remain high, it will be, or these levels, it may be even higher. But there is one problem we have in the U.S., namely the capacity of the pipelines. There is a need to, if U.S. is serious, to export more oil, and there is opportunity there. We need to make more investment, and we need to open the way for new pipeline infrastructure development there. But U.S. coming in the picture changed the entire dynamics of the oil market. So therefore, I believe there will be more volatility in the markets, but I don't think that we can see oil prices very high for a very long period of time.
Help us understand what that means for the role of OPEC. So last week, the regular OPEC meeting, it was a decision to increase output. That decision has basically been taken by one OPEC member, Saudi Arabia, working with one non-OPEC member, Russia. But does, when you take a step back from this, looking at the large sweep of history, does the organization you used to work for at OPEC, do they become less relevant, irrelevant perhaps? How should we think about that?
So it is, of course, difficult to talk about, to say it is relevant or not relevant. But what I can tell you, U.S. is a major producer, growing exporter, and still many deposits to discover, changed the dynamics of the energy markets. And as such, the established role of the traditional exporters are different now. It will not change. And to be very frank, David, we are working on a subject now at the IEA with several of the people from those countries. Given the shale oil coming big time, given the technologies, again, on the oil-consuming side, such as electric cars, renewables coming, it is the high time for the economies, producer economies, which are one-to-one linked to oil prices. It is now for them time to diversify their economies. Otherwise, they may well have some major difficulties, and it may be very late. Mm-hmm. Saudi Arabia now has a Vision 2030, Emirates is doing something, but they should, and Russia as well. You work on Russia a lot here in Brookings. So it is, if they are not able to change their economic base, they may well make strategic mistakes there. When it comes to OPEC, the decision OPEC taken, we welcome any increase in production, whether or not it is good enough or too little, too much. It's a matter of calculation. But one thing I am seeing in the oil markets, in general energy, that I don't like very much, geopolitics is back to energy. Look at Venezuela. Look at Iran. Look at Libya. So there are several difficult issues in terms of markets and market deficit, and therefore it is time to producers to increase the production.
So let's talk about the geopolitics there. You mentioned some countries that are getting the message about reform.
Yeah.
Saudi, most interestingly, Russia for a long time, including on the public budget. Some other countries not doing so well, Venezuela. Venezuelan output is half, maybe lower, of what it was before Chavez took over. There's essentially no serious new investment. How should we think about when the wheels come off the bus in Venezuela and what that does to global oil markets?
I think my English is not very good, but I think wheels come off. I understand what you mean. I think wheels already came off. This is, and we are already. So it is
no wheels.
No wheels. I don't know if the, it is, and we. It is very, very difficult. I mean, it is so dramatic that such a country, one of the richest energy resources in the world, is in fact in a position to import oil products. This is really a very tragic situation, and I hope that it will be restored. But the solution will not go through energy. It is beyond energy if you want to solve this problem.
What about Mexico? Mexico has done a tremendous amount on the reform front. We just in Brookings have a paper out in the last 10 days, first ever systematic public opinion poll of what average Mexicans think about those reforms. But when you set aside what average Mexicans think, what we see in the presidential campaign and the likely winner is a populist who has said he will reopen the contracts, he will try to stop corruption, he will roll back elements of the reforms. Is that something, as somebody who looks at the oil markets, Mexico's a major producer, in trouble, is that something that worries you, or do you think they're going to sort it out?
So I think if, first of all, we work very closely with Mexico. Mexico recently joined the International Energy Agency as a member. And it is the, in the shortest period of time, a country became a member, because to be a member of the IEA is not very easy to be. And there are many, many, many procedural things, tests, assessments.
It's like becoming a member of the Galatasaray football club.
Oh, this is something much more important. So this is Galatasaray is very important. So by the way, Mexican team is doing very well. They even won against Germans. So which is now we follow. And I think I wouldn't call Mexican energy reforms, because when I look at the depth and the breadth of it, it's a Mexican energy revolution. Oil, gas, renewables, energy efficiency, new technologies, it's huge. And I believe all these steps were in the right direction. But these are, as we know, in energy business, you get the returns, not immediately, but a couple of years later. Like in the, there are two areas in life where the investment has long lead time returns. One is the energy, the other one is education. You don't get it immediately. You have to invest and it comes back. Now, Mexican oil production was declining, and as a result of the opening up, many companies coming and putting money and the capital there and technology, we are expecting Mexican decline will again bottom up and rebound in a couple of years of time. And this will be good for the Mexican people, because it will be income growth for them, and the money in their pocket will be much higher than in a declining term. So, in my view, it will be a great pity, a dommage, very, very, very bad, if those reforms are reversed and that capital, that technology is kicked out and we go back to the old times. We talked about the country a few minutes ago. One should be very careful what one is going to do. I don't know who will win the election, what this person or that person will going to do, but to turn your back to the getting capital, getting new technologies, opening up and increasing the production, if you turn your back to that and go back to the old times, then you may end up similar developments as the country we just talked about.
So what do you do as an international organization when, imagine, after the election, López Obrador wins, and it's not quite clear which forces inside the cabinet are going to triumph, but he said a lot of things on the campaign trail, and he said he's going to honor those. We have a president here who said a lot of things on the campaign trail and appears to be honoring them, for better or for worse. What do you do as an international agency in that situation to help help Mexico not be the next Venezuela?
So, David, as you know, you say things before take the office, and when you take the office, the life may be different. For example, before I became the executive director, my biggest aim was to buy an espresso machine for my office. And it took me more than 1 year to be able to buy that espresso machine, because the life is not so easy. There are many things that hinders you to do it. So I believe I hope the common sense will prevail, and the existing contracts will be honored. The right steps, the good steps in the right direction will be kept. There may be revisions here and there, which I can understand, but I really hope or that the main direction will not change. And we will be advising the new government of Mexico, whoever takes the office, definitely in that direction. Because one thing we do at the IEA, we, without fear and favor, we say what is right. And then afterwards, up to government to take it or not. We have the same thing with the German government, with the Dutch government, Japanese government, and others.
Yeah. One more question about oil, and I want to move on and talk about some other fuels. One of your upheavals is the rise of America, which is just extraordinary. In this town that's sometimes called energy dominance, help us understand, there's no question that the revolution inside the United States has generated jobs, it's generated output. Does it generate a political benefit? I mean, can you take energy dominance out for a drive and do something with it? Or what do you see geopolitically happening as a result of this upheaval in America?
So dominance or not dominance, I should see the following.
It's not your word, it's their word.
Yeah. So I would say the following. I'm an energy person, and I like to talk about only energy issues. But let's assume an international meeting, a summit, or a bilateral meeting with the U.S. and another country, whoever this country is. A U.S. Secretary of State is a major energy importer 10, 15 years ago, and a U.S. Secretary of State is a major energy exporter. I think the second one, Mr. Pompeo, today, would be sitting in his chair much more comfortably compared to his predecessor. This is only what I can say. And to be very frank, if we talk about gas, leave the oil aside for a moment, the U.S. gas production growth is a good news for many people around the world, okay, including Europe, where we live. I give you one number. I was thinking this for our press conference tomorrow, and I hope our press officer is not here. It's a very interesting number, because we found out this weekend, last weekend. Now, in Europe, one of the major issues is how we will diversify from Russian gas, as you know very well. Why, first, there were many bitter experiences, as we know. And second, even if those experiences wouldn't be there, or even it was not Russia, to be depending on one single country is not a... I mean, you want to diversify, not only the gas, but everything you want to diversify in your life, to have the more to be on the safe side. And Europe took this as a decision, as a strategy, to diversify from Russian gas, as we all know. But last year, 2017, again, our data shows that while the policy was in that direction, diversification away from Russia, we have seen the highest Russian exports to Europe, 35% of total consumption. It's huge, 35%. And the decision is this that way, and the what is happening is just the opposite. So therefore, I think U.S. LNG, it can be the North African gas, it can be Norwegians, it can be, I don't know, other kind of Australia, whatever it is, or Canadian. So there is a need for diversification of the European energy and gas imports, and U.S. is a very important option here. And I mentioned in the beginning, even if the Europeans don't import one molecule of American gas, when they negotiate the price with the Russians and or others, the very fact that if they don't agree on the price, they can have other option will make their hands stronger in terms of price negotiations. So therefore, the U.S. shale gas helps the Europeans or others. It may not be because you want so, the Americans want so, but as a result of the availability of other options makes the hands of the Europeans stronger when they negotiate the contracts.
So let's talk about gas for a little bit. The Churchill said about oil security that security comes from diversity and diversity alone. The picture that you've outlined about natural gas is the gas is harder to transport long distances, but now we see this incredible shift from pipeline long-distance gas to now more and more LNG gas. I think the number of countries importing LNG is tripled, maybe more than tripled. It's just an extraordinary transformation. Has that, I sense from your comments that that diversity tells us that that Western Europe should be less worried about its backbone dependence on Russian natural gas. This has been a question that many people in the United States have worried about for a long time, because we worry about the reliability of strategic partners who are dependent upon Russia. Have they turned the corner?
I think you summarize it very good, David. I mean, if it was not even Russia, another country, it would be risky to 35% of your gas comes from one single country. If it was not, if it's a tiny country. And Russia is not a tiny country, we know that. So therefore, it is even more risky. So therefore, in my view, it is now time the European and the U.S. policymakers should come together and discuss seriously how they can make the most out of this. I think it is the, I believe the gas can make the this recently the widening Atlantic a bit bring it narrower, in my view, and which will be good for U.S. and good for Europeans.
Let me tell you, ask you about a particular project that's just this week around the edges of the World Gas Conference. BP and its partners are celebrating the opening of the Southern Gas Corridor. This is a project that brings gas from Azerbaijan across ultimately Turkey and into Europe. Does this, you're Turkish originally, does this bring Turkey closer to Europe?
I think this is a, first of all, this project is a wonderful project because it will help to bring the Azeri gas to Europe. It's and helps the diversification that we were talking about. And I believe this project coming from Azerbaijan to Turkey and to Europe will be an important bridge, another important bridge between Turkey and Europe, which is very much needed and good for the Turkish and the regional gas security.
What... help us understand the outlook for gas globally. When you think about the three major fossil fuels, your projections show demand for oil rises. Your projections show that demand for coal a little bit rises, but frankly, the Chinese coal consumption is basically flat. The big growth now is in India, not in China. But your projections show global growth for demand under almost any scenario rising to an extraordinary level. Even the scenarios that stop global warming at 2 degrees see big growth in gas and then a leveling off. How should people in the industry think about whether that kind of bullish under any scenario vision of the future is right, or what's the biggest risk?
We think gas has a bright future, but there are two major risks for gas, that it will not grow as much as we project. Number one, if the price of gas goes up significantly and gas loses its competitive edge vis-a-vis coal and ever getting cheaper renewables. So this is the price of gas. If it stays at affordable levels, there will be huge demand, especially in Asia. Second, very important in my view, environmental benefits of gas, and one of them is in terms of emissions. Methane emissions are very important. And when you look at the methane emissions today, we are seeing significant amount of methane is leaked to atmosphere through production, distribution, transportation of gas. If the gas industry cannot address this methane issue, and this can be, we have shown in our reports that this can be addressed with existing technologies, and half of the emissions can be minimized or nullified at zero cost, half of them, methane emissions. And this is a huge thing, and I can tell, to put in the context, this half of the emissions from methane that we can completely get rid of at no cost is equal to the emissions coming 2/3 of the coal plants in Asia. Just let me repeat, because the sentence may not be very clear. The methane emissions today is a major problem coming from the gas. And half of the methane emissions today can be mitigated at no cost. And this at no cost mitigated half of the emissions is equal to the emissions coming from the coal plants, two-thirds of the coal plants in Asia. And this is a major homework for the gas industry. So they have to make sure that the prices don't go up too much, and the second, address the methane issue.
So those are two pretty big risks when you look at the global picture, and yet your own projections show demand rising consistently, so it sounds like you think the probability of those risks is low.
Yes, we assume that they take the decisions in the right way, and the industry will address, because there is one big advantage of natural gas, and it is the reason why today in Asia it is growing very strongly, namely local pollution. We talk about environmental issues, the first thing comes to mind is the climate change, but there is the other one, local pollution. And today, in many countries, they used gas in order to reduce the local pollution in the cities, SO2, NOx, and particulate matters. It's a major issue. It's a major issue. It's a big benefit for gas vis-a-vis coal.
Let's talk about climate change for a little bit. You mentioned in your opening remarks this inconvenient fact. You said it's a fact, not fake news, real news. It's an inconvenient fact that last year emissions are up 1.6% or so, depending on whose data you look at. The largest single increase comes from the United States. That's mainly because gas is almost free in the United States, and so it's out-competing coal, crushing coal, out-competing nuclear, which is not as good news on the carbon front. That has nothing to do really with climate policy. It's just reality. How do you think about whether the world is even remotely on track to stop warming, not at 2 degrees, but 2.5 or 3 degrees. I mean, one can develop from energy models scenarios that get you to 2 degrees. They involve kind of some magic. You guys have scenarios. Everyone else has scenarios like this. But when you take a step back and you look at where people are really investing, I mean, is this just hopeless?
One thing I should say before, it's a very good question, before, and I will give a blunt answer to that, but just let me tell you, 2017, U.S. emissions coming down from gas, but also a lot of renewables in the United States, coming both solar and wind. Now, to be honest with you, we look at the numbers. Many countries, many governments make statements and this and that, but when I look at the numbers, not only 17, 16 numbers, but we know, David, looking at the projects which are under construction, how much of the emissions in the future are already committed. It will come because these projects are being done. I tell you something, in Asia today, 200 gigawatts of subcritical coal-fired power plant are under construction. And it's 200 gigawatts. Okay. So now, looking at those numbers, looking at the political situation, looking at the priorities of the countries, and looking at the very fact that if we want to be on track with our scenarios, other scenarios, we have to see a peak of the emissions very soon. The idea was 2020s. And to have a peak of emissions, 2020 is, I don't know, two years.
But in the long lead time industry, 2020 is over.
Yeah, it's finished. So therefore, I would be too diplomatic if I tell you that I don't know. I am really not very, very hopeful now that we will be able to reach our targets unless there are major, huge technological breakthroughs. So this is, I should say, because it is... unfortunately, it is a case. I mean, look at the data. I mean, you get what are we today? How much the carbon budget is left? And you look at the all the committed under construction projects, their type, and the emissions come from there. It is not even you don't need a model. It's a more subtraction, additional subtraction thing, and you can get the numbers. So it is very easy. But I wouldn't be pretending, being too diplomatic to say this and that. It is becoming less and less possible to reach the targets if there are no major, huge technological breakthroughs or huge political breakthroughs, both of them doesn't seem to me very likely in the very short period of time.
Let's talk briefly about both on the technological front. The first day of the Paris conference in 2015, there was a big announcement to the effect that many countries were going to double their spending on public sector energy-related research and development. That would increase the flow of new ideas. Bill Gates was up there saying he's going to do things as well, which he's done. How are we doing in terms of doubling the spend and making the investment in new technologies much more effective? IEA's own tracking suggests that in a few areas like solar, some stuff on data centers, a couple of other areas, we're on track, but almost everywhere else we're still lagging. So that's not very optimistic.
So we look at every year. We trust the governments. Trust is good, but control is better, we believe. This is something said by somebody.
It's trust, but verify. Yeah, trust, but control.
Yes, control. So we trust the governments, but we still control them. So we look at what they said and what happens. So we look at, very recently, 38 key clean energy technologies, 38 of them. How many of them are in line with the targets that they should go? We have found only three. Solar, electric cars, and digital technologies, smart grids. Only three of them. And other 35 either doing so-so or completely off track. But in terms of investment in clean energy research and development, until 2017, 4 years, it was almost flat. This is the government and also private sector. But 2017, we have seen a significant jump, 13%. Very good. And again, the biggest jump in terms of the clean energy technologies came from the United States, followed by some European countries and China.
Does this suggest, and I want to ask a political question about this, does this suggest that all of the noise in this town, in Washington, about not doing climate policy and back rolling back the previous administration's climate policy, does all that, frankly, not matter? Because on the innovation front, the United States is still doing a tremendous amount. On gas replacing coal and lowering emissions, the United States is still doing a lot. Is all this just noise, or does it have an effect on the politics of the climate problem?
So, it's a very good question. I cannot make such political sweeping arguments, but when I look at the numbers, I see that some of the numbers are coming from U.S. are good, but it is as a result of this or that, I don't know. But there is one political move recently that I should say I welcome this very strongly. This is the 45Q for the CCUS, giving tax credits.
This is a change in the U.S. tax law that allows people who build carbon capture and storage projects to get, depending on exactly how the project is designed, credit that can be worth up to $45 a ton for CO2.
So, thank you very much. So, this is
I'm always happy to interpret the American tax code.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. And your English is perfect. So, the thing I wanted to say is the following. For me, when I imagine if there are no technological big breakthroughs, one of the things I see is that if CCUS can be helpful here, because of the following, David. Why CCUS? Now, you know the entire history of the climate change and all of this, the debates. And in 1987, I don't know if anybody is my age, I think I am the oldest in this, there was a Mrs. Brundtland, the former Norwegian prime minister. And now the United Nations Secretary General in 1987 asked this former Norwegian prime minister, Madame Brundtland, to make a report called Sustainable Development. This concept came for the first time. And her report was the first, the Bible at that time when it comes to environmental issues. And one of the most important recommendations was to reduce the share of fossil fuels in the global energy mix. Very clear, 1987. And at that time, the share of fossil fuels in the global energy mix was 81%, 81. And in the last 30 years, of course, there was a, I mentioned the cost of renewables came down, There were lots of green movements, technologies improved, many countries became much more, and the citizens became much more aware of the environmental challenges, and renewables are growing. This 81% in the year 2017, after 30 years, came to 81% still. No change. This is the reality. So, therefore, when we look at the future, fossil fuels will be still, if you want to be realistic, part of the energy mix for different reasons I can explain in hours and hours. And there is one technology which can bring this fact with the climate goals together, which is the CCUS. But current appetite in 2017, when we look at all clean energy investments, CCUS investment share was 0.1%, nothing. So it is the reason I think this new tax credits in the U.S. may be a driver for it. And IEA works very hard on the CCUS together with the U.K. government. We are just before the 2 weeks before the COP meeting in Poland. We organized a high-level meeting with many CEOs, many ministers, with the U.K. minister to push the CCUS part of the climate change debate in Poland in the COP meeting. So I believe this is an extremely important story that the fossil fuels, we may see in the newspapers, this is growing, renewables, they are all growing, but fossil fuels still there. They are very stubborn. Economic facts are cheap. Energy is very stubborn. And let's don't think that the world doesn't exist of Washington or Brussels or Tokyo. There's huge China, India, Africa, Asia. They are the ones who are using more energy than others.
I want to ask you two more questions, and we'll put it open to the larger audience discussion. On electrification, it's a very strong result in the energy modeling community that a world that decarbonizes is a world that electrifies. Yeah. The world's already electrifying, but the shift to electricity is even more accelerated, because you can burn fossil fuels in plants with carbon capture and storage. It's easier to control emissions from a small number of plants run by adults than, you know, millions and millions of sources dispersed throughout the economy. So I think we kind of understand why that is. Your own projections see a shift to electricity. Electricity is growing twice the rate of the underlying demand for primary energy. It's a super capital-intensive business with a lot of risk, possibly more risk now than there has been in the past because of all these changes in technology. How optimistic are you that the capital is going to be mobilized to allow this pervasive electrification?
Now, I will tell you something that is, again, perhaps I talk too much, I gave too many numbers, but this is, I have to tell. So, in the year 2017, when we look at the investments, electricity investments, 95% of the electricity investments took place in the regulated environment, only 5% in the more market environment. So therefore, we are seeing the electricity companies are more and more need security, long-term security for their investments. If it is not there, it is very, very difficult. And as a result of that, we are seeing many changes in the electricity generation side, electricity technology side, especially this 5% area. One of them is perhaps the only technology that we didn't talk up to now is nuclear energy. Big thing is happening in nuclear energy. I testified in the Senate, I told them, for me it is incredible. If I was an American citizen, I would look at that number and I would think twice. Namely, David, years and years, United States had the highest nuclear power capacity in the world, followed by France, where I live. But in both of these countries, there are no significant new builds. Two, many of them, even though they could have lifetime extensions, they are not getting lifetime extensions from the authorities, or they think market conditions are difficult. As a result of that, both of their capacity, if the policies don't change, go this way, and only 6 or 7 years of time, China becomes the largest nuclear power in the world. This is, for me, it's something incredible. So China, a country which started only 10 years or perhaps 15 years ago seriously on nuclear, overtakes United States and France, became the number one nuclear power of the world. And this has many implications. I can tell you one of them. US, France, Japan were the countries who were exporting nuclear technology to other countries, their nuclear technologies and so on. And now, and there is something learning by doing in the, you know, very well in the technology, bring the cost down. But there is opposite thing. How can I say it? Forgetting by not doing. So there are many things in life. If we don't do a lot, we forget how to do it, like the bicycle and other things. Now, in that respect, China, by learning by doing, bring the cost down. And the cost of nuclear technology in the established, like US, Japan, and European countries stay high. And we may well see China, like we saw in the solar power, one day, to maybe Russia as well, being the nuclear technology exporting country. So this is a big change in the nuclear domain with huge implications.
And I would say just not just China, but also Korea. I mean, overnight costs of building a reactor in the United States now are maybe $6,000 or $7,000 a kilowatt, and they're $2,000, maybe less than that, in China or Korea. It's not surprising that Koreans are building those four reactors in Abu Dhabi. Last question. Your projections, you mentioned at the beginning this important issue of electrification, low-income communities. Over the next decade, we're going from having a billion people, roughly, who don't have access to electricity to 600 million or so who don't have access to electricity, essentially all in sub-Saharan Africa. Are we stuck at that point, or do you see the emergence of microgrids, private sector solutions, not grid extension, the way China did it or the way the United States did it, as the solutions to this persistent failure to electrify the rural populations in Africa, or are they stuck?
So I am hopeful for two reasons. One, from a democracy point of view, in Africa now, many leaders, they may be Democrat leaders or not Democrat, understood that if they want to have the support of their people, they have to, one of the first, very first conditions is now bring electricity to them. This is one. This is a, became a social driver. Number two, renewable energies are vast in the huge. In Africa, we have 325 days in sub-Saharan Africa, very direct radiation of sun, even more than Germany. So if you can look at this.
Shocking, because normally I think of Germany as a very sunny place.
So, yeah, sometimes. 325 days. Hydropower, huge potential. And wind, offshore and onshore wind. Now, the good thing is this political and social driver and the cost of declining cost of renewables come at the same time. 10 years ago, renewables were expensive. There was an excuse, but now it is going cheaper, and I believe we will fix the problem of sub-Saharan Africa through renewables and also natural gas, Tanzania, Mozambique, Nigeria, and others. So we will see in Africa something for the first time that we have never seen in the history of energy. When you look at the U.S., for example, or Europe or China, throughout the economic development process, they use a lot of coal and then left coal, went to gas, renewables, and others. Look at US, look at Europe, look at China. And India is the same. But in Africa, we may have the universal access with leapfrogging directly going to renewables.
Cola.
Exactly, going to renewables and the gas.
Okay, we have time for some questions. I think we're going to group three questions. And if you could stay focused on a question as opposed to a dissertation, That would be great, right here. And please say who you are.
Hi, Brian Scheid with S&P Global Platts. My question is about the OPEC deal. Do you think that's enough to stave off this potential supply shock we could be seeing in the next couple years?
Second question. Right here, please. And the last one's going to be back there.
Energy efficiency wasn't mentioned much. What do you see happening is driven by regulatory. You see the world going that direction?
Mm-hmm. Last? Right there in the glasses? No, that's fine. Great.
Hi, Blaine Johnson from the Center for American Progress. I was curious as to what your thoughts were about the maximum share of China's natural gas demand that the U.S. could expect to occupy, or whether China would just benefit from what you're describing of lower prices. And yes, thank you.
Okay. Thank you. So, short answers. We are going to have, in the oil markets, we are going to have a significant deficit because of Venezuela free fall of production. Iran shipments is a major issue after the U.S. administration's decision. Libya, we have a serious problem in Libya. We are losing about 500,000 barrels per day there. So there is a huge deficit there. And the recent decision taken by the producers in Vienna is welcome. However, whether or not it is sufficient enough remains to be seen. We hope to see the producers to increase the production even more in order to stabilize the markets and address this huge looming problem in the oil markets. Second question about energy efficiency. I'm sorry that we didn't talk about energy efficiency because it is very important. We call it at the IEA, the oil, gas, renewables, we call the energy efficiency as the first fuel. But I can give you one tell you how important it is, one recent study we made. It's about air conditioners. Now, again, we always bring it to the developing countries because where the things come from. In the United States and in Japan today, 9 out of 10 buildings have an air conditioner, 9 out of 10. In Asia and in Africa, when you look at there, the only 8% of the households have an air conditioner, 8% versus 90%. And with the increasing income levels, we expect they will buy air conditioners, these people, and they should buy because for comfort you need it at 50 degrees centigrade. And the only additional electricity demand coming from air conditioners for cooling is equal in the next three decades, is equal to the current U.S. plus EU plus Japanese power fleet. Just that. You know why? Once the demand is very strong, and the second, big chunk of the boxes, air conditioners are very, very inefficient there. If they were to have the efficiency standards, minimum efficiency portfolio standards, as they call it, like they have in Japan, for example, this demand quote will be easily halved. Efficiency is extremely, extremely important. And for especially for the when it comes to electric sector, but not only that, also trucks and others. I can talk hours. China and U.S. I think there is a huge opportunity for both countries there. Chinese growing gas demand, mainly driven by the again air pollution concerns, making the skies of China blue again, and United States, I will give the numbers tomorrow to international press, X amount of growth of the world coming from United States in terms of LNG, and I could think there is a very good marriage de raison, so the logical marriage. How do you say it, Jet?
No, it's logical marriage.
Logical marriage is the good. Some marriages are logical. You are right. So this is a.
I didn't say that. That's fake news.
What, you mean all of them are logical?
No. But, I mean, just in thinking about the transport distances, most likely the American LNG is going to go into the Atlantic Basin.
Yeah.
And then what's going to happen is that cargoes from the Persian Gulf and Australia that might go to the Atlantic Basin are going to end up in China.
Yes, definitely. But I also believe that the Australia is coming on board. There will be, we shouldn't forget, Australian growth. And, in fact, what we think is, David, in the next six years of time, there will be the champions league of the LNG exporters, all about 100 BCM, Qatar, US, and Australia. This top three will be there. And there will be, of course, competition between them as well in terms of the prices. And also, as you rightly mentioned, many countries are building LNG import terminals. There were five beginning of the year 2000s, and they are very soon they will be close to 50. So 5 to 50 countries have this LNG terminals.
Just in time for the Qatar World Cup. Yeah. Before we go to the next set of questions, very quickly, there's a trade war underway. Steel is a part of it. The oil and gas industry uses steel like nobody's business. The latest list of retaliatory products from China includes U.S. oil and gas technology and a variety of other exports. Are you at the International Energy Agency worried about this trade war having a larger knock-on effect in the global oil and gas industry?
I think when we look at the history of economy of energy, there are always trade disputes between the countries. There is a looming one coming. We are saying it will not be the first and the last, not the last one. I can only hope that it will not have a major impact on the energy trade. This is, and I would hope that it's a very naive thinking, but the energy remains as a business. It is not affected from geopolitics or the trade disputes and the others, but we will see how it goes, but hopefully it will not have a major effect on the energy world.
Next questions. Right here, you've been very, exactly, glasses there, and then... Yep.
Good afternoon, Dr. Fateh. I'm Shruti Shukla, and I work with the Global Wind Energy Council. I just have a question on what do you think is the implication of the drop in storage prices, especially in the lithium-ion batteries, and what do you think it's going to happen in 20, 25 years or so in terms of the energy mix?
Thank you. Next question, Reed.
Reed Dutchin with the United Nations Foundation. Thank you both for your leadership on energy access issues over the years, Fateh, and also for this very good analysis. I wonder if you'd get into the speculation realm and suggest how these trends might be affected by carbon pricing, either regionally or globally, and what the likelihood of that is and what time frame.
Thank you. Last question right here.
Doug Faulkner, Leatherstocking LLC. Your agency has been a strong supporter of global growth of biofuels. You didn't talk about that much, but because it was mostly about the utility sector. But could you discuss that briefly, why you're such a strong supporter and what the implications are?
So let me start with, again, a brief answers. Storage. The storage costs are falling down significantly. If we want this storage to be a part of our energy system, they still need to fall substantially. We are in the beginning now. And how it will go substantially down, we need government support. Without government support, if everything is left to the markets, we will not see a drop at a satisfactory level that they will be commercially competitive in the energy system. Thank you very much for also your leadership in terms of energy access, electricity access. When it comes to carbon pricing, I will give a very French answer. So what is the French answer? This is the yes, but at the same time, yes. So this is, I will give yes and no. Yes and no. Okay, yes and no. Yes, carbon pricing is, in from an economic theory point of view, it is the best way to reduce the emissions. I completely agree. I think nobody can debate on that. However, there are two problems. This is no part. To have a internationally effective carbon price, where the biggest part of the emissions are coming from, to see it happening is, in my view, not very realistic, where we are now. When I look at the, I go all the countries, China, India, Indonesia, here, United States, Europe, to see that it is happening in the carbon price, that the, without the carbon leakage to have an international carbon price, it is not realistic in my view. Again, carbon pricing is the best in theory. Second one is, if we want to reach the our targets, climate targets, we have to see that the emissions need to peak sometime very soon, 2020. And we cannot wait. I mean, the carbon price accepted, discussed, how much, $3, $10, $15, to be effective currently. It can be in the future, maybe a part of the solution, but we need, in my view, major breakthroughs if we were to reach our targets. Major breakthroughs in terms of technology or in terms of political breakthroughs. Otherwise, it will not be, in my view, possible. Biofuels. So biofuels, we are a strong supporter. Yes, we are a strong supporter of sustainable use of biofuels. In fact, I would invite you to look at our renewables report coming on 8th of October with a major analysis on biofuels trend, including its potential. And how does it compare with solar, wind, and others, which are very much talk, which are very much in the press? We think sustainable use of biofuels can be a very good part of the both the finding solutions to energy security, but at the same time our environmental problems.
Are you more optimistic about biofuels, basically the biofuel solution to sustainable transportation or electric vehicles? In the IEA projections, you suggest that we could have 125 million electric vehicles by 2030, up from 2 or 3 million today. That's a huge change. Yeah. That seems like that's the revolution and not biofuels. Is that right?
So electric cars is something very, very interesting topic. Last year was a record sales. 1 million cars sold last year, and we reached 3 million electric cars. 1 million cars sold, and after there are now 3 million electric cars in the streets of the world, and half of them is China, other half everybody else put together. It's a big record. We always read about electric cars and your famous company here in the United States, starting with T. And this is
they're famous for losing money.
They are very famous. I don't know. In Europe, we see every day. This is very good. But we at the IE, as I said in the beginning, tried to put the things in a context. This 1 million cars sold, it's a record, huge record, but it is still 0.8% total car sales. 99% were internal, not the traditional cars, and only 1% less is electric cars. They are going to grow very strongly for two reasons. First, generous government subsidies. In France, you have 6,000 euro subsidy if you want to buy an electric car. And second, the cost of batteries are coming down. And this is going very well. But, ladies and gentlemen, there is a discussion on the is electric cars, does it mean that it is the end of oil? This is a discussion everywhere. And I think this is, we think, in fact, I should say, we think it is not at all like this. At all like this. Not out of, I ask my colleagues to calculate, not out of 100 cars was electric, but if as of tomorrow, every second car sold in the world was electric car. So one electric car, one traditional car, instead of 1 out of 100, global oil demand growth will still continue to increase because oil demand growth is coming from trucks, petrochemical industry, jets, and shipping. Cars alone is not the only and not even the main driver of the the oil demand growth. So therefore, electric cars will grow, but it is too early to announce the obituary of oil.
Okay. We will stop writing that obituary right now. A last round of questions right here first, sir.
Yes, my name is Ted Conwell. I'm with Climate First. And you mentioned that you weren't hopeful that we could stay under the Paris targets unless there are, quote-unquote, huge technological breakthroughs. Other than carbon capture and storage, what other breakthroughs are you talking about?
My name is Mark Grossman. I was wondering, sir, whether you might be able to talk a little bit about the Eastern Mediterranean, where it seems to me there's this combination of more gas being found, more politics, and how you see it connected to the rest of the energy system in the world.
And then last one right up here.
Yes, thank you very much. My name is Mindy Reiser from Global Peace Services. We have all thought that solar might be the great white hope. And yes, I know we want technological breakthroughs, but what do you see as really possible in terms of solar?
Okay, so the first question, except for CCUS, what other technological breakthroughs could change the game? I would say another one is the question that our colleague asked or mentioned there in the beginning, the storage. If we see the cost of storage falls down much faster than what we are seeing now, and if it becomes the part of the electricity system, this could be an excellent news in terms of the making the renewable energies and others part of the equation. Renewable energies are growing, but it is their growth is alone not enough to bring us to a 2 degrees or Paris trajectory. When with the Paris targets, I don't mean the NDCs, but I mean the what is set in target by many countries. East Med, we have a huge discoveries there, but discoveries made in a, if I may say, in the wrong time, when there's a lot of gas in the market. To develop those resources is not very easy in a abundant shale coming to the markets. What I expect is Egypt, for example, the Zohr field. It's a huge, very, very, very good field, but this will be mainly used for Egyptian domestic gas needs. Israel will do the same. And I don't expect in the short term major export from Mid East to the rest of the world. Maybe in the medium and longer term, but for this, not only economic, but there are some serious political challenges as well. Solar energy, I think this is, as I mentioned in the beginning, the cost is coming down substantially. Just let me give you one example. Between 2014 and 2017, in 3 years of time, cost of solar is halved. I don't know any other good that the cost is half divided by two. And we expect it will continue to go down. But still, growth of solar is alone is not enough. And here the Chinese policies will be extremely important. Because today, 6 out of 10 solar panels manufactured in the world are 6 out of 10 Chinese manufacturers, other 4 is the rest of the world put together. Huge potential for solar, but still, again, solar alone cannot solve the problem. Please let's remember the following. Our energy problem is not only power sector. There is the industry sector, there is the transportation sector, there is the building sector. Electricity is one part of it, and currently we use solar mainly for the power generation and sometimes for water heating in some countries. Maybe in the very future, we may make much more use of solar, But I hope that very future is not too late for the imperatives we have today, especially in the context of environmental issues.
No, although one implication of what you said earlier is that maybe too late is too dramatic, but but this looks like the Paris targets are getting harder to reach. Just as we're wrapping up, I want to ask you one last question, Fatih. I sense in your remarks today some skepticism about whether the kind of normal market forces can address these challenges. You talked about carbon pricing, that in some sense it's going to be hard to figure out what the right prices are. Meanwhile, governments need to go out and get things done. You talked about storage and the need for, in addition to all this market-led tremendous advancement in storage, at least some kinds of storage, there's a need for more government support in that. We were talking about investment in the power sector, and you made the point, very wise point, that the vast majority of the investment is in state-owned firms, regulated firms, in part because they're larger globally, but also because the risks are lower. So, I mean, as an economist, does this make you uneasy? Because it seems like the solutions here have to be more state-led than most economists would be comfortable with.
Now, we have, in the energy sector, we have many challenges, many problems, but some of the problems we have, especially those on the environmental front, are so, first of all, I should say, make a disclaimer. We work a lot with the energy industry. You know, at the IEA, we have one of the most active energy industry group with all the oil companies, Exxon's, Shell's, BP's, the utilities, and so on. And, you know, I have another hat. I am the chair of the energy board in Davos, World Economic Forum, where all the energy industry is there. But some of the challenges we have today are so huge and so immediate challenges, imminent challenges. If we want to address those challenges, there is a need for a collective public answer to them. We are not in a position to leave everything to the market to expect this big answer coming from there. It can be together with the private sector, together with the energy industry, but I see a leadership role from the public institutions are badly needed here.
A very French answer. Please join me in thanking Fatih Birol.